Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. A year ago, I logged onto Wikipedia to edit the entry on the MRI device used to save lives in hospitals around the world. It's a controversial article because of the dispute over who really invented magnetic resonance imaging and who should have won the Nobel Prize for its discovery. Well, I had noticed that Wikipedia's history section of their article was out of chronological order. So even though I know that the Darwinist evolutionist over at Wikipedia, that they edit with a heavy hand, I attempted to make a modest correction. Dr. Raymond Damadian, he is a biblical creationist, which the Nobel Committee may not look favorably upon. So I made enough successful changes over the years on Wikipedia that when they're voting on top editors who will have authority over disputes there, I get an invitation to vote. And I've read the history section of 100 articles there, entries, and their brief thumbnail sketches of the chronology of the development of a technology, a discovery, and so on. So I thought I'd put the history section of the MRI into chronological order, just making one change, because it mentioned one of the Nobel Prize winners first, Paul Latterbur, saying that he invented the MRI in September 1971. But you go down two paragraphs further, and Wikipedia acknowledges that Dr. Raymond Damadian published a paper in March of that year. That's a full half year earlier. And that was in the prestigious peer-reviewed journal Science, reporting that tumors and normal tissue can be distinguished inside the body by nuclear magnetic resonance. Well, not surprising, as expected, within a short time, other editors at Wikipedia rejected my update, insisting that the history of the discovery of the MRI is presented out of chronological order so that Paul Latterbur and not Dr. Damadian would be mentioned first. Wow, what a shock. So it is my honor to welcome Dr. Raymond Damadian to Real Science Radio. Hello, doctor.
Hello, Bob. Pleased to have you.
And you're an actual medical doctor, right? You're not a what they might refer to as a real scientist. You're a medical doctor.
That's right, Bob.
Well, I've had an MRI. About how many MRIs are done annually? Do you have that estimate?
I'm going to guess that, but there are about between 2,000 and 3,000 done per scanner, and there are 7,000 scanners in the world.
Wow.
So that would be about between 21 and 50 million MRIs a year.
Oh, my. Do you have any idea, Dr. Damadian? I know your company is a major provider of MRI technology to hospitals around the world. This discovery that you described in the journal Science in March of 1971, you have any idea how many lives that the MRI has saved?
Well, I don't, Bob. I can't estimate that, but I'm gratified to know that it's a great many, because what the MRI overcame was a major deficiency in medical imaging, which was the inability in a standard X-ray image to be able to see the soft tissues of the body, the vital organs, the brain, the heart, the kidney, liver, and spleen. And the X-ray's ability to distinguish one tissue from another was less than 4%. Happily, when we made our discovery with MRI, we were able to make distinctions between those vital organs of 130%. And all of a sudden, all the vital organs of the body came into exquisite detail.
Wow.
And we could see the tumors. And most importantly, we could monitor the tumors while they were being treated to assure that the treatments were achieving something.
Wow.
The problem you had with x-rays, if you couldn't see the lesion to begin with, you certainly couldn't monitor whether
the
or not
treatment.
It was being bettered by the treatment in use.
Right, if it was effective. Now, in a moment, I'd like to ask you to describe the technology itself. But first, there's a newer version of the MRI. It's the upright MRI, and it looks way more comfortable. How did that come about?
Well, the way we got attracted to that was when we discovered that more than half the patients that were being scanned, which was a surprise to us because my original orientation was to be able to do something successful about cancer. When we got the scanners and started them in use, we found out that more than half of them were coming for low back pain and that it was inadequate to scan the patient lying down and take all the weight off the spine that was generating the pain. Mm. So we consequently then re-engineered the product so that the patient could be upright, and that put us in a position to ask the patient when the patient came in. The upright MRI allows us to put the patient in virtually any position. Mm-hmm. So if we had to put him head down, we can put him head down. And it enabled us to ask the patient to position himself in the scanner in the position that caused the pain so we could snap a picture in the pain-generating position, which you can't do with a conventional MRI. What was happening was that because patients were not in the fully weight-loaded position, it was fairly common that you didn't see the pathology at all, so you couldn't make the diagnosis. I mean, you didn't see the herniated disc. You didn't see the narrowing of the neural canal because you took the weight off.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for making that clearer so that I could understand it. Can you describe the technology then for us, Dr. Demedian? Not totally in layman's terms, because our science radio program has aired for many years, and we've attracted a scientifically literate audience. So if you were describing this technology to a class of engineering students, say at a university, how does the MRI work?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that when we make an MRI, we are making a picture of approximately 65,000 pixels. And the word pixel stands for picture element. So analogous to the half-dot prints that you have in a newspaper print, this is 65,000 dots. And what the image acquisition has to do is set the brightness of these pixels to set the brightness of the dots. And that's how we make the image. Now, the key to that is collecting from the interior of the anatomy the signals that make the picture. And these are genuine radio signals, but they depend on a fortunate discovery called nuclear magnetic resonance that was made in the early 1900s, that under the right conditions, the atoms of a sample, including the atoms of a body, if you put them into a magnet and you excite them with an ingoing radio signal, those atoms will answer back with a radio signal of their own. And early on, I was using the technology to do some of my experimental scientific research, and I had a question in my scientific research which was centered around how the human body or any living anatomy is able to generate electricity, because it's a phenomenon we take for granted, but it's extraordinary. I mean, each individual walking around is his own Con Ed plant, and, you know, where's that electricity come from? Well, the short answer at the outset when I was starting my research is two scientists in Britain, Hodgkin and Huxley, had discovered that that electricity was originating from the asymmetric distribution of the charged potassium atom, potassium ion, inside the cell relative to the outside of the cell.
There are ion pumps, right, in the cell membrane.
Well, wait, oh, I'm coming to that. Okay.
Yeah, okay, great.
What was the situation was, in a living, normal living cell, you had 150 millimoles per liter of potassium ion inside the cell, and you had four on the outside. But the curiosity was you had exactly the reverse with respect to the sodium ion, 140 sodium outside, four on the inside. Now, so the obvious question was, how did the cell do that? How did it distinguish potassium from sodium and accumulate potassium and generate electricity and exclude sodium? Well, the postulate at the time was there was a protein sitting on the surface of the cell called a sodium pump. And that sodium pump had the discriminating capacity, supposedly, to pump potassium into the cell and pump sodium out. Mm. And that's where my career started. the professor I had at the time, A.K. Solomon, Dr. Solomon, I said, "Dr. Solomon, has anybody ever isolated this pump?" And his answer was, "The guy who does that's going to win the Nobel Prize." I said, "Oh, okay, I want to work on that." And his thought was, "All right, the maiden, we've been working to find this out with bacteria, E. coli. What I propose you do, Demaiden, you make a mutant of the E. coli bacteria that can't accumulate the potassium. Oh. Then we'll have the parent strain and the mutant, and we can search them down for the protein doesn't match, and that's the pump."
Wow.
I said, "Oh, okay, that's a good idea, Dr. Wow. Solomon." So I started looking for that mutant. And I said to Dr. Solomon, "If this is such a viable enterprise, if it's such a viable entity to sell, how do I know that it's even going to be possible to isolate a mutant?" And Doc Solomon's answer was, "That's your problem, Demaiden." Anyway, I got started. And after about 6 months, in the research I was doing at Harvard, I isolated a mutant. I couldn't do it. And so now I was dead earnest to track down and look for the protein that didn't pair up. I was drafted at that point into the Air Force, and I was fortunate that they sent me to the School of Aerospace Medicine in San Antonio, Texas, where I spent another 2 years looking for this pump. Mm. And then I came back to became an academic at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center for 6 months, still looking for the pump. Finally, I had now been looking for this pump by protein fractionation for 3 years. I said, "Well, gee, you know, Demaiden, you better be sure that the evidence for the existence of this pump is stronger. You'll look for it the rest of your life." So I went to the library and looked extensively for the evidence supporting the pump. And the first thing I found was a big book by a PhD chemist named Gilbert Ning Ling, Physical Theory of the Living State, 500 pages presenting scientific evidence that the pump did not exist. And there was a massive amount of scientific evidence to accumulate. So I went to the library and I researched extensively and found that the evidence for the existence of this pump did not exist. And so as I was pursuing this, I said, "Well, I can't just throw the whole thing out. If there's no pump, what is doing it?"
Yeah.
And one of the obvious first steps was that, well, this potassium atom that's generating this electricity, this potential, has a positive charge. So maybe it's just sticking to the negative charges on the inside of the cell.
Well, Dr. Demaiden, can I ask you a question about,
sure,
of course, our worldview affects our assessment of the world around us. And since there's so many scientists who have accepted the secular Darwinian worldview, to fathom that there could be an ion pump in a cell membrane is just startling. Could it be that there was a disposition against that kind of sophistication that led some to think that no such thing would exist?
Well, it was just a hypothesis, you know, mm-hmm, that there was, in fact, a pump. Just that the evidence, and people hadn't examined the evidence very carefully, and I examined the evidence, I couldn't find support for it.
Right.
But anyway, so I came on with an alternate hypothesis. Instead of this potassium being pumped, maybe this positive charge was just sticking to the negative charges that were part of the structure of the cell. Like the proteins were loaded with negative charges, and nucleic acid were loaded in the nucleic acid. They were fixated inside the cell, and in order to meet the condition of electrical neutrality, they had to be positively counterbalanced. So that's why the potassium as a charge ion was sticking there. Mm. But the missing question was now, why potassium and not sodium?
Okay.
And that was the question that the pump answered, because the pump just miraculously chose potassium and excluded sodium. Now that I was coming to the conclusion from Gilbert Ling's hypothesis and others that the pump didn't exist, was I had to have an alternate explanation. And one of the apparent alternate explanations was the substance that was making the choice, that largely is not highly attended to in biochemical science, was the water inside the cell. Hmm. And the prospect that the water itself was making the choice. About this time, I got a phone call from Freeman Thorndike Cope. And Cope said, "Look, Demaiden, I've been reading your papers. You think potassium is complex to the interior of the cell. How'd you like to prove it?" I said, "Well, what are you talking about, Cope?" He said, "Well, look, I've got time on a nuclear magnetic resonance machine. And if you're right, and potassium is, in fact, sticking to the negative cells on the inside of the cell, we should be able to see that by measuring the relaxation time of the potassium resonance." And I said, "Cope, that's a good idea." So then he called back about a week later. He said, "The one thing I'm worried about, Demaiden, is that the the potassium NMR signal is not that strong and there's not that much of it in the cell to begin with. I said, Cope, that I may be able to help out on. I know where I can get a bacteria from the Dead Sea that has 20 times the normal potassium.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So he says, okay, well, let's go ahead and do the experiment. So we went out to a small company in the outskirts of Pittsburgh that made NMR machines, and I grew up these Dead Sea bacteria, and Cope ran the machine and all the electronics. And I grew up the bacteria, spun them down into a test tube, so I had a pellet of these bacteria. I handed the test tube to Cope. He put it in this NMR machine, which had a magnet gap in it of about 2 1/4 inches, and in an instant, he measured the potassium.
Wow.
And I said, Cope, I can't believe what you did. I said, you just measured potassium on the inside of a test tube without ever invading the sample with an antenna around the sample. I said, Cope, you realize that if we could do that on a human body, we could go from one tissue to the next and get its chemistry non-invasively. We would spark an unprecedented revolution in medicine if we could do that, Cope.
Dr. Demedian, when was that?
1969. I was hoping he would collaborate with me to try to see whether or not this NMR signal could indeed distinguish diseased tissue from normal tissue. Because my plan was to take some rats with tumors and take some normal tissue from the same rats and see if this wonderful NMR signal would see the difference between the two tissues. And he didn't want to do it. So I went to the president of the company, Paul Yaiko, and I asked him, I said, Paul, I said, can I come back to the company in a few weeks with rats that have cancers in them? Because I want to cut the cancers out and put them in a test tube and see if they're different. And he said, sure. So 2 weeks later, I came back with the rats, with the cancers. I cut the cancers out, put them in a test tube, cut the normal tissue out, put them in a test tube. And to my delighted amazement, they were dramatically different. Now that meant that we could now envision building an antenna go around the human body that would detect the radio signals from this NMR technology that would detect the radio signals from cancer tissue inside the body. And there was another very important discovery, by the way, and that is that as in order to determine whether or not we were observing something fruitful on the cancer, we had to measure all the normals. And we had to measure the signal from all the normals. And what we found on the signals from the normals is they, too, differed dramatically. The signals differed by 138%, whereas by X-ray, they only differed by 4%. Now, what that meant was that if we go back to these pixels that make the image where I said there were 60,000 of them, if the signals were all different, it means that we were going to be able to code each of these picture elements with a different brightness. And that was going to enable us to see all the vital organs of the body, which medical imaging had never seen before.
Wow. So before we continue then with the MRI and the controversy that I really want to ask you about, this idea that the body is able to generate electrical fields, early on, biologists realized that migratory birds, sea turtles, were able to sense the Earth's magnetic field. But over time, Dr. Demedian, it seems like they are finding out that there are thousands of species of animals that are able to detect a magnetic field. So that this goes down to the very core of what it means to be a biological organism, this ability. And in fact, there's not only a DNA code. Now there are biologists telling us that there's a DNA code, a sugar code, an electromagnetic code that has a lot to do with the development of an organism from its embryonic stage. So this is all fundamental to biology.
Oh, it's very fundamental. And, of course, the interesting thing is that when you have a living organism or a living human cell and you put the probe in, you measure a voltage that's 90 millivolts. But at the instant of death, the 90 millivolts become 0 millivolts. So what is really remarkable is that the living species is its own Con Ed plant.
Yes. Yeah, that is extraordinary. I became aware of the controversy about who invented the MRI years before I needed my own for a neurological problem, which has since been resolved in my arm. It was back in the year when the Nobel Prize for the MRI was awarded, that there was this fascinating full-page ad in the New York Times, which, if I recall, quoted their own reporter's chronology of the discovery, this ad, and it was paid for by friends of Raymond Demedian, Can you remind us, Dr. Demedian, which newspapers ran that ad and what the ad said?
The ad said specifically the shameful wrong that must be righted, because there was no question, when you looked at the details of the history, where the idea of scanning the human body originated and the discovery that made it happen, which was my discovery, that the signals coming from disease tissue were different than normal tissue. So when it was an offense to the truth of medicine about the origin of MRI, it was painful in particular to me, because in the years that I was developing and trying to get the first scan, it was being ridiculed from every center on the planet, being called visionary nonsense. And in one case, I was invited to give a lecture at an NMR conference where there were 100 or 200 NMR specialists. Oh, and one of the things that was significant is that when you did NMR the usual way and you put the test tube in this 2-inch magnet, in order to overcome inhomogeneities, you spun the test tube at 10,000 RPM. After I was done giving my talk, the chairman of the conference said, "Now, Dr. Demedian, how fast in your scanner, how fast do you propose to spin the patient?" That's what I had to endure in the early stages when I was, and there was another group from Johns Hopkins, a scientist at Johns Hopkins, when it presented some data where he showed that the NMR signal from cancer tissue was different than the NMR signal from normal tissue, which was my discovery. And he went on to show that the NMR signal from other disease tissue that was not cancerous was likewise different from normal tissue. And he ended up concluding, this Hopkins science, therefore any further discussion about scanning human body by NMR is visionary nonsense. And this was a major conference at the National Institutes of Health, and it was very distressing. Years later, when we got in a big patent fight over this, our lawyers ended up saying to the jury, "Listen, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are you going to punish this guy because his original discovery detects more disease than he originally envisioned?"
Right. Right. In fact, the early report of your discovery, you guys had basically a press conference, and a reporter from the New York Times came, local television, and rather than reporting this extraordinary breakthrough that could change medicine for billions of people, they reported it as it was a failure because one of the guys on your team didn't have cancer, and so you guys failed to detect cancer in his body.
You know, that's what you have to live through when you do something new. I ended up inventing a name for them. I call them the GSQs, the Guardians of the Status Quo.
Yeah, back in 1971, I was still in grammar school, as we call it in New Jersey, and you were proposing this technology to the medical community. The scientists were not receptive. They're mocking skepticism, as you've put it. Thomas Kuhn, in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions, suggests that it's rather typical that scientists will mock a new technology, new discovery, and so on. It wasn't too long before you became the first researcher to actually do this magnetic scan of a human being. It was one of your team members. I think you called that scan the Mink 5.
That's right, exactly.
Can you tell us about that first scan?
Yeah.
And then eventually, the world of science, they became believers. But that first scan is a fascinating story.
Yeah. The big jump now was that we were making this bizarre proposal that this magnet that had an opening of 2 inches in it to take a test tube, we were suddenly going to replace this test tube with a human body. And we were going to have it make a giant magnet that was going to be big enough to allow this human body to go into it. And then the second problem was that when we were doing it on a test tube, we had an antenna, which was literally a circular loop of wire that was wrapped around the test tube, and it was only a few millimeters in diameter. And now we were talking about an antenna that had to go around the whole torso that was going to be 2 feet in diameter. And the problem was that in the test tube sample, that antenna was only going to be millimeters away from the atom that was generating the radio signal, which is a weak signal to begin with. And now we were going to put it 10 inches away, and everybody thought that there was no chance that the antenna would still be able to collect that signal now that it was 10 inches away when it barely collected and was millimeters away. That was the big uncertainty. So we went ahead anyway, and we built the first scanner, which we named Indomitable because of all the things that it had to surmount. And when it came to trying to perform the first scan, nobody would get in there. So it was finally decided by some manner of consensus that the person who most deserved this wonderful opportunity was the guy who thought it up. So I had to get in there.
Now, Dr. Demedian, this machine, you determined that you needed 30 miles of superconducting wire, titanium wire, to make this thing. And it turns out that it cost about $1 a foot. So not only did you conceive of the concept of this, but you had to then do the engineering, you had to do the fundraising, you were doing the public relations work to bring in the funding, and publishing in journals. So all this is going on almost simultaneously, which is an extraordinary feat. So then you do build this thing, and you get in it. So at that point, so then what?
There's an interesting piece to that puzzle. Once I had to build this big magnet, I had to get the technology to design the magnet. And I had a friend at the Brookhaven National Physics Laboratory here, and he gave me the software to do the calculations. And I had a big pile of IBM cards I put on our computer at the university. I calculated the amount of wire I had to make in order to make this big magnet, because now this magnet was going to be a coil of a special kind of wire called superconducting wire that you mentioned, niobium titanium. But this was going to be a big circular coil that was about 5 feet in diameter, and it was going to all have to be made from loops of this special niobium titanium wire. So when I calculated the amount of niobium titanium wire I had, the calculation came to 150,000 feet, 30 miles of wire. And when I did the calculations, the Westinghouse price, which was the only entity that I knew at the time that made this wire, $1 a foot. So it was going to cost me $150,000 to make one of these coils, and I needed to make two of them. And I didn't know where I was going to get the money. So in the interim, though, the wire I knew did not all come on one spool of wire. It came on 10 spools of wire. So as I was going to go ahead and do this building, I was going to have to make joints.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart interrupting my own show. We've run out of time for today's interview with Dr. Demedian. So please tune in next week, because this just keeps getting better and better. And February is our telethon month, so if you can help out, please call us at 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Or go online to realscienceradio.com or take the shortcut, rsr.org. You can click on the store, make a donation, a one-time or an automatic monthly contribution, or you can browse our science department and purchase any of our great science books in DVDs. I think you'll love them. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Science Radio, keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.